you're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is being hailed as a national leader in the COVID vaccine rollout, but access remains uneven. The state's racial, ethnic, and other minority groups face major barriers to inoculation. Bram Sable-Smith reports on efforts to reach these communities.
Barbara was thrilled to learn that she and her parents would qualify for COVID vaccines in January. The 28-year-old education student lives with her parents in Milwaukee, and all three share caretaking duties for Barbara's young son, who is on the autism spectrum. WPR is withholding her last name because of her parents' immigration status.
We got a letter from the health department just stating that we, as a household, qualify for the vaccine just because of we are taking care of a child with special needs.
Barbara has shouldered more caretaking duties during the pandemic because her parents work outside of the home in fear exposing the child to the coronavirus.
So it was a relief for me that they were going to be vaccinated and get close to him.
She quickly booked three appointments at Walgreens, but when they showed up, she says pharmacy staff turned away her parents because their IDs were expired. Barbara herself presented two current IDs, but says she was asked for additional proof of residency.
I'm not sure if they were questioning my immigration status, but they were questioning my residency.
Her residency, that was right there on the ID. The family decided to leave. A corporate spokesperson for Walgreens said they could not comment on Barbara's case without a privacy waiver, but noted that while they check to make sure the right person is there for an appointment, state-issued IDs and U.S. citizenship are not required to get vaccinated. Still, Barbara's experience highlights the barriers that are fueling disparities in Wisconsin's vaccine rollout, even as all adults become eligible in the state starting today.
There's been a lot of messaging for folks to call this place or register online, you know, all of these different things. And people are not thinking about the people that don't have a phone right now, right?
Melody McCurtis is deputy director of Metcalf Community Bridges in Milwaukee. Last month, eligibility was expanded to 10 Milwaukee zip codes in an effort to reach more minority neighborhoods that have seen a larger share of COVID cases and death. But Metcalf Park was left out, so her group brought vaccines to the neighborhood. McCurtis is canvassing door-to-door to make sure residents know about the aid events where they can get a shot. All they need to do is show up.
And we're hopeful that folks are going to come out and get the vaccine now that it's in a walkable distance.
The Mung Institute in Madison is also hosting vaccine clinics. That's where 56-year-old Suvit Tao got his first dose in March. Sitting in a waiting room where a Hmong language video gave information about the vaccines, Tao answered questions through an interpreter. He says he's looking forward to being able to go out more once he's fully vaccinated. The clinic is held at the Life Center Church in Madison. It's a familiar location for many elders in the community. The Hmong Institute runs a culturally and linguistically accessible mental health program here. CEO Peng He says it's important to provide a familiar space like this for Hmong elders. Many face trauma around vaccines and medical care before arriving in Wisconsin as refugees. In some cases, He says, military forces in Laos would round up villagers for mass vaccination events.
And so you fast forward to now when even the testing site at Alliant Energy Center, right, the National Guard was there to help, right? So then obviously that helps triggers a lot of the things that they witnessed and saw back in Laos.
In Milwaukee, Barbara was able to find vaccine appointments for her and her parents, albeit a month later. It's frustrating, she says, because she knows many Latino residents are facing similar hurdles.
A lot of us want to get vaccinated, but we're not given the option to get vaccinated.
As of April 1st, Wisconsin's percentage of vaccinated white residents was twice that of Latinos and nearly three times that of Black residents. Bram Sable-Smith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And that story comes from a reporting partnership between WPR and Wisconsin Watch. Now to vaccine passports. What do you think about a system to require people to prove they've been vaccinated against COVID? Join in, 800-642-1234. Glenn Cohn is a Harvard Law School professor with expertise in bioethics and health law. Glenn, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, give us a working knowledge, if you will, of vaccine passports. We're hearing about them. What are they?
Great question. So vaccine passports is what is commonly referred to, but it's a bit of a misnomer. These are essentially proof of vaccination that might be used by the federal government, by a state government, by a private employer, by a commercial entity. So I prefer the term health passes or digital health passes. Other people use the idea of licensing. And the idea behind them is that for certain kinds of things in the economy or in society, maybe that's crossing a border. That's what the EU has been talking about using it for. Maybe it's about returning to a particular workplace or going back to a university. We'd require proof of your vaccination status and also track what kinds of vaccines people have received and when they've received it.
Yeah, in this digital health pass, as you call it, you know, it really reminds me of a digital wallet, not just verifying your vaccination status, but also keeping track of your COVID tests, your results, you know, logging positive or negative results. How do you envision an app built out like this with your health data on COVID?
Yeah, so I think we should be careful here in that the question is what data should be contained in it. So there is a question about whether your vaccination status really is health data as we traditionally think about it, right? We're not asking you for your medical records. We're not asking you for your family history, for your comorbidities. We're asking you essentially to show us that piece of paper, if you're lucky enough to have been vaccinated, that you received. And I can tell you, for many years traveling the world, it's extremely common to have these little books about yellow fever or hepatitis showing your proof of vaccination that you have to show when you cross a border to sub-Saharan Africa or East Asia or the like. So the idea is we could make this a lot easier through an app that recorded this information. We've seen Israel already do this. The EU is beginning to roll this out. New York has a pilot project called the Excelsior Pass for going to see a sports, for example, or a concert. And the idea would be that we would basically have a central repository where you could include proof of vaccination. And then rather than having that little card, when required, you could just show the app. And one nice thing about this, if it's done properly, is it means you don't you're not at risk of losing your little card. And perhaps more importantly, we can defend against forgery or other kinds of problematic ways of circumventing such a system.
Yeah, and we'll get into forgery and fraud in just a bit. But let's bring in Mark in New Berlin. Mark, hi. What are your thoughts on vaccine passports?
Good morning. I was going to say that I'm undecided, but listening to this a little bit, I'm totally against it. I'm totally vaccinated, at least for COVID and for flu. But who decides what conditions allow you to be able to move in society? Is it if somebody decides later that I didn't get a flu shot next year, that I won't be able to go to a sporting event or a grocery store? Well, I don't understand who could decide this.
Yeah.
For us. And I've seen in this, if you haven't learned anything from COVID, you've learned that the medical opinion changes over the course of a year.
Very fluid.
And
yeah.
It's really scary, especially with the administration we've got right now.
Mark, thank you for that. And I want to ask you then, you know, who takes the lead here on a system like this, Glenn?
Yeah, so my own view. So thank you, Mark, for the question. First of all, just to put this in context, as I've said, we've been doing this for a long time when it comes to international travel. This is well established. What most Americans might not know, though, is that actually historically in this country, we've had similar regimes for smallpox. So if you go into the late 1800s, early 1900s, it was the case that many employers, miners, factories wouldn't let you work there unless you could show that you had a smallpox inoculation or you could show the scar which proved that you had had smallpox. So this is, you know, just to say, historically an old idea. I think there's a lot of sensationalism over the term passports, but the idea that there are certain things in a society you can't do unless you can prove that you can do them in a way that won't put others at risk is a very traditional idea. Think about a driver's license, right? The fact that we require people to show competency to drive. That's because we don't want them to put others at risk on the road or themselves at risk. And really, that's what the essential idea behind these digital health passes are. Can we basically have people indicate that they are at lower risk so that we can begin reopening America? And are they a less restrictive alternative then the idea of keeping things on lockdown and not letting anybody back to work or anybody back to university. And they're an interim step. But I hear what you're saying about the slippery slope and the idea. I'll just say that I think that, you know, one of the great things about the political process is that the politicians hear from voters like you. And there is something of a check there in that I think the governor, for example, might have a very different attitude towards COVID than he would for influenza. But there are some workplaces, you think about nursing homes, for example, where maybe it is important to show that you are vaccinated against influenza.
Well, yeah. And then you mentioned the slippery slope. I mean, it's a, you know, a nursing home, or is it enrolling in a public school, or going to a Badger football game, or boarding an airplane? And, you know, as you say, this comes down to how much risk should people accept to respect the rights of Americans who don't want to get vaccinated?
Yeah, but it's not just the rights of Americans that want to get vaccinated. It's also the rights of Americans who don't want to be infected with COVID or don't want to pass away. And again, I think that the important thing is that it's not about restricting people's rights simpliciter. Mm-hmm. It's about a less restrictive alternative than the idea of shutting down Badger games or shutting down the University of Wisconsin and making all the students be virtual. Would it not be better to say if there are students who can be there because they are lower risk, we should open the doors to them at least? So it's not against liberty versus pro-liberty. It's a question about deciding what the least restrictive alternatives might be.
Let's bring in Joe now in Weston with thoughts. Joe, hi, go ahead.
Oh, good morning. So we go on a yearly trip to Canada fishing since like 1984. And I know the director of tourism at Sunset Country up there in the region we go. And there, he's telling me already that Canada is looking at strongly at verifying COVID vaccination before you can enter the country when the border does finally open. So, I mean, you can harp all you want about liberties down here, but it won't do any good if you want to fly to Switzerland or go to Canada fishing with a group of guys. I mean, and as far as liberty goes, like, look at motorcycle helmet laws. And then there, in that case, you're not hurting anybody else except yourself if you don't wear a helmet. Why weren't people crying about laws to have to wear a helmet? You know, I mean, you get fined if you don't wear a helmet in many states. So it doesn't fly as far as people saying personal liberties on a lot of things, you know.
Joe, thanks. What do you make of an analogy to motorcycle helmets?
I think that's a helpful analogy. I mean, seatbelt laws are the other. But I think the important point that the caller just made is that if those laws are justified, these are even more justified. Those laws are just about protecting yourself from danger. These are about protecting others as well. And again, the idea is the state is not saying we're going to tie you down and jab you in the arm if you don't want to, but to say, just as with public schools where we require the kids to have certain kinds of vaccination, in certain settings where you're being unvaccinated might increase dangers, we're going to say if you want to enter them, you should have to do vaccination or wait it out till we get to herd immunity. Choice you have for yourself. And I think it's just a question of what we as a decent society require people to do. And, you know, we have a long history of requiring vaccination for travel, for school, for the like. This is just expanding the pool. But I do agree with the prior caller that who decides is vitally important. And I am afraid that we're going to get into a world where you have thousands of employers, thousands of businesses having to make their own decision.
And I'd rather see sector. Yeah,
exactly. I'd rather see government coordinate at least to some extent so that we don't have this much fragmentation.
Glenn Cohn, our guide, he's a Harvard Law School professor. Scholarly work at the intersection of medical ethics, healthcare law, big data. Do you have privacy concerns about sharing if you've been vaccinated for COVID or not? When do you think proof of COVID vaccination would be warranted? When does it cross over into government intrusion? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about vaccine passports. President Biden's top health advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, told Politico Dispatch yesterday that he doubts the federal government would mandate vaccine passports, but
there may be theaters that say you don't get in unless you have proof of vaccination. There may be colleges or other educational institutions that do that. I'm not saying they should or that they would, but I'm saying you could foresee how an independent entity might say, well, we can't be dealing with you unless we know you're vaccinated.
Harvard Law Professor Glenn Cohn is with us for 10 more minutes. Let's take another call now. Jeff is with us in Delafield. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Interesting program. I've been listening for maybe 15 minutes, and I'm going back and forth. I tend to think that having a proof of vaccination is a good thing. However, I can understand the other side of it, that it kind of gets back to this just this hyper partisanship we have in government today. And let's face it, so many people just don't trust government anymore. So I think if we had more trust in our institutions and they garnered more trust in the populace, more of us would be on board with, let's say, doing the right thing. That's my comment.
Jeff, thank you for that. Glenn, what do you make of that and having more trust in government to do the right thing?
I think the caller identifies what I view as a real tragedy of this pandemic is that public health has become a politicized thing. Now, you know, there's always been politics over things like tobacco, let's say, and the like. But the idea that there's a global pandemic and we view this through our tribal lenses of red versus blue is really, really sad, and something that I think when historians look at this period of history, they really will find puzzling. Now, one thing I'll say that's interesting to me is that the Kaiser Foundation just did a survey. They do these periodic surveys. One thing they found was among groups of people who said they're in the wait and see mode about getting vaccinated or in the definitely against mode of being vaccinated, when you tell them you may not be able to get on an airplane if you're not vaccinated, they change their mind about their willingness to get vaccinated. So there is a way in which some of this private efforts to require passports or this idea that people will have different kind of opportunities to engage with the world or the public may actually shift people's behavior towards vaccination. So I think that's interesting, and maybe that in some ways seeing this will help destroy some of these differences, these divisions in our society. But who knows?
How do you, though, put safeguards in place around unlawful discrimination and these health disparities that we see? I mean, unless you have a fair and equitable system for administering vaccines, wouldn't a passport concept just deepen the disparities?
Great question. So two separate questions. On disparities, I think you're absolutely right. And before we introduce these, I think we have to be in a position where we feel as though all Americans have an opportunity to get vaccinated. We're not there now. We're getting much closer. And we're also, as you know, some of your reporting has suggested earlier in your hour on the news, we're in a position where we're actually needing to reach out to minority communities in particular rather than waiting for them to come to us. But the good news is we are reaching a place where in the U.S. at least, we will have access for every American who wants it. But that's in the U.S. What do we think about low and middle income countries where there hasn't been a single vaccination yet? Mm. The idea that these people across the world will be prohibited from our shores or from, you know, coming here or from entering the United States. Think about students, foreign students, for example. That's really upsetting. And that's why I think any rollout of these kinds of passports, especially in terms of internationalism, has to be coupled with a commitment to making sure that we are providing vaccines to these hard hit countries. On discrimination, your second question. Here, I just want to indicate that all of this is subject to the oversight of civil rights statutes like the Americans with Disabilities Act and also Title VII for employers. And what that means is, when it comes to employment at least, if you have a medical contraindication, a disability such that you can't take the vaccine, your employer is required to give you a reasonable accommodation. You have a religious objection to taking the vaccine, your employer is required to consider a reasonable accommodation. So a scheme like this that has this as a general rule can still make room for the idea that there's individuals who, for whatever reason, just can't go through with the vaccination. And we can do both. We can walk and chew gum at the same time.
We're talking with Glenn Cohn, who's a Harvard Law School professor, bioethics and health law expert, as we look at the ethical and political issues. Let's go to Kia now in La Crosse. Hi, Kia.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if the passport would apply to include people who have had a documented case of COVID, because as a nurse who works in urgent care, I've been starting to see a lot of people who've had negative reactions to the vaccine, especially if they've had COVID prior. And now my coworkers and I have been chatting that we've been testing less people positive for COVID than we have had people coming in with vaccine reactions. Hmm. So to the analogy that the caller made about not wearing a helmet, I'm of the opinion that the COVID vaccine, from what I've seen in firsthand experience, can have negative physical consequences for some people. And like the actual disease being Russian roulette, you're not sure who's going to get really sick and who's just going to be fine. It seems to be the same way a little bit with the vaccine. Ethical about it being mandated.
Kia, thanks. Kia has concerns about the ethics, as we've been talking about, of having a mandate in place and the side effects of a vaccine, and also as we look at the variants that are now circulating, and how would you people with a vaccine passport ensure the credentials that the protection is still valid?
Yeah, this is another reason why this passport is a good idea, to be perfectly honest. It's because we can track with the information about when you were vaccinated and what vaccine you got. We can basically use that information to update as we see new variants emerge. If we learn that one of the vaccines is less good as to one of the variants, or its durability has worn off after a certain period of time, by having this information centrally deposited, we can adjust the status of determining if you need a booster or something like that. Mm. That's why it's crucially important to have centralized information on who's been vaccinated by what vaccine when. And that is an infrastructure we don't really have a great system for here in the United States compared to our peer countries, if I'm perfectly honest.
Glenn, thank you for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Glenn Cohn is a Harvard Law School professor, bioethics and health law expert. Stay with us next hour as we discuss how screening practices for lung cancer have changed for smokers, with a pulmonologist and radiologist as our guide. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.